part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Well, hello. Great to have you along this afternoon for the Country Hour. Before the news at 1 o'clock, the markets back on again this week. A little disruption last week to the markets with the Anzac public holiday bang in the middle of the week, but it's all back to normal this week. So John Testrow along with the Mouche cattle results for you just before the news at one. And I mention that right now because last week you and I were having a talk about the prices at the sale yards, and we looked particularly at the Mouche cattle and the Mouche sheep market, both of which had slight downward pressure because of all the talk in the live export industry at the moment. Obviously, it's centred around the sheep exports to the Middle East, but those implications for the market and the prices that producers are taking home, even having an impact in the cattle market, and then again at Mouche for the sheep market. So we'll get the results with John just before the news at one, but also not too far away, sort of some analysis around that, because as a result of those changes we're seeing in the sale yards, the Mercado has done some market analyst analysing around this and has been looking back over, well, past years' records and prices and comparing to what we're seeing at the moment. So we'll go over those details for you shortly and see if you can guess what this researcher is talking about.
It's that complex, rich, buttery flavor, and those butter notes are ones that are incredibly craveable, and so it almost becomes almost like chocolate. And so think of it almost as the chocolate of meats.
Rich and buttery, chocolatey. What do you think that is describing? Maybe venison? Wagyu beef, perhaps? No, none of the above. She's actually talking about mutton. That's right, good old mutton. Shortly on the Country Hour, you're going to find out what they've done to mutton to make it so appealing. Or maybe you love it already. You can let me know this afternoon. The text 0448 922 604. 7 past 12. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio WA. Well, the competition regulator, that's the ACCC, says there is a lot of room for improvement when it comes to working out a contract between the dairy processors and the dairy farmers. The balance of power there is certainly on one side, and it's on the processor's side is what the ACCC has found. And it thinks the best way forward is to have a mandatory code of conduct when it comes to working out these contracts. And it believes that mandatory code would really help the farmers. The ACCC's inquiry was a response to some, well, rather large and retrospective reductions in milk prices by two major processors. This is going back a couple of years. So the ACCC has been looking back over the last 18 months or so. And Commissioner Mick Keogh says he thought about continuing with a voluntary code, but to be honest, didn't really think that would address the big imbalance of power the processors have over the farmers. So he thought it best to go with this mandatory code. But as Mick Keogh will tell you, there were a few concerns about going down this road.
There's an argument that the existing industry voluntary code is improving behaviours, and that's certainly the case. The problem is that there's a number of processors who aren't participants in that, and there's some weaknesses in the voluntary code. And it was put to us that if that voluntary code is strengthened, there'd be even less participation by existing processors. So that's not an option. Therefore, we concluded that a mandatory code is the best way to change that culture of behaviour between processors and farmers in the industry.
And what about the power of the supermarkets? Did you look further at that?
Yes, we did. That's been a very intensive investigation involving mandatory information disclosures by participants right through the supply chain. The conclusion isn't much changed from where the interim report concluded. When we look at the contracts between processors and supermarkets, almost always they have a farm gate price pass-through mechanism. So in other words, they take the farm gate price that the processor has had to pay for the farmer's milk as a starting point, and then negotiate over the processing costs. So that highlights to us that it's that weakness in the bargaining power between the farmer and the processor that leads to the difficulties and the transfer of risk and lower prices to farmers. So unless we address that part, unless we address that step in the chain, everyone else passes back the risk and the lower prices to the farmers because of that. So that's where the real issue is. And we observed and repeatedly observed that irrespective of whether a processor is supplying dollar milk or not, the price is no different from a farmer's perspective. So unfortunately, it's become a real focal point, and we understand that. But when you look at the practicalities of it, the impact that that has through the supply chain in terms of farm gate pricing isn't obvious at all.
So you've not made any call for any changes to dollar milk, or you've not made any undertakings or forced any sort of mediation on that?
No, and look, we've observed that it's a completely unreal price. It was set at an arbitrary level in 2011 and hasn't changed since then. So in real terms, it's declined quite significantly over that period of time. It will eventually have to be abandoned. You can't just simply, retailers can't just simply say forever and ever, that's the price of milk. And we understand that farmers are very incensed with it in many respects because it devalues the work they do and the value of their product. But aside from that, we think it is a bit of a distraction in terms of what's happening in the industry more generally.
Some people have a question whether or not it should be called milk because it's so watered down, there's nothing left in it, no real milk fat in it and that sort of thing. Is that an ACCC issue?
No, it certainly wasn't in terms of this inquiry, and we haven't had a reference in that regard, so we might leave the quality of milk to others to sort out.
The other issue is Murray Goulburn and the changes there. Did that come into the purview of this report at all?
No, that was a separate issue. That is, the takeover of Murray Goulburn by Saputo was referenced to the ACCC. We considered it from a competition perspective and made the recommendation that if Saputo disposed of the Koroit factory, then we didn't see any other competition impact. So the difficulty was that Koroit and the existing Saputo factory were very close together and two of the biggest milk factories in that region. So therefore, Saputo owning both of those would have been, in our view, a lessening of competition for farmgate milk. Saputo has agreed to an undertaking and is in the process now of disposing of that factory, which will bring competition into that region.
ACCC Commissioner Mick Keogh speaking there to Michael Condon. Interesting point. I mean, the ACCC, as Mick was telling you, looking into that dollar per litre milk in the supermarkets. And hasn't it been a long time since it's been around? I hadn't quite realised. 2011 it was first introduced in the major retailers. So having a look at it in this particular inquiry, but finding that, well, understanding dairy farmers are frustrated by the retail price of milk, deciding that the price set by the retailers is arbitrary and has no direct relationship to the cost of production for the supply of milk. So no direct relationship between the retail private label milk prices and the farm gate prices. So Mick Keogh saying that the concentration really has to be between the processor and the dairy farmer and that contract being signed. So deciding that the best way forward, really, the key finding in that inquiry is for a mandatory code of conduct when it comes to working out the details of that contract. 14 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti with you. Checking in with the news headlines, a look at the weather right around the state around about half past 12 today. Well, the live export industry has certainly been right up there in the headlines recently and mainly due to animal welfare concerns. But let's have a look at the prices right now. And we'll have a look at the cattle to get started. Feeder steers leaving Darwin are at their lowest level in about 2.5 years. So getting $2.80 per kilogram. Matt Dalgleish is market analyst. He's from Mercado. And he says the current live export numbers are consistent with the five-year average.
There was a slightly slower start to January where it was a bit under the average, but pretty much February and March have been pretty close to the average levels. So you're looking at about the kind of 70,000 head per month, or they're about 75,000 head per month.
In Darwin, there was record numbers exported in January, just a bit over 30,000 head. So does that mean the other ports didn't quite reach what Darwin was doing?
Yeah, it's... I haven't had a look at the particular breakdown out of the ports coming out of Australia, but that makes sense. If they've had a record and we're pretty much sitting in average, it means the other ports would have had to have been, or you've got one port that's, you know, significantly under, perhaps.
Where have the cattle gone? What can you tell us about the breakdown of the destinations of those ships?
The flows to Indonesia are the largest, of course, and they're sending about 50% of the trade so far this season. However, if you kind of compare it to the two other, I guess, main destinations being Vietnam and China, they're actually trending for the quarter above average. So you've had Vietnam with a very good start to January, above average. It was just about around the 17,000 head in January. They had a bit of a drop in Vietnam in Feb, which was probably slightly lower than what you'd consider as the seasonal average. And then March has kind of come up with a fairly strong one for Vietnam of 15,000, or they're about 15,700 head. So they've had a really good start. Vietnam and China as well have been, had probably an average start to January. They didn't do much at all in February, but then the March figures for China were significantly higher than average. You're talking about three times more than what you'd normally get, so about nearly 16,000 head going out of Australia into China for March.
Feeder steers out of Darwin dropped below $3 a kilogram for the first time in 2.5 years. It dropped below that mark just a few weeks ago. They're now, there's the latest quote I've got is for $2.80 a kilogram.
Yep.
What can you see happening to that price over the next quarter?
Oh, look, generally speaking, you do tend to see a rise in volumes, particularly going into Indonesia as we head into April. That's the seasonal pattern. Some of that price fall, I think, has been mirrored in what we're seeing broadly across the Australian market in terms of cattle prices, that we are seeing, you know, prices across the whole of the country decline. So there's an aspect of that that's impacted upon, I think, the live trade there. My personal feel is, given what we normally see in terms of volumes, you know, coming into this next quarter, that they usually tend to pick up, and certainly going into Indonesia they tend to pick up. So I'd expect that you'd probably start to find a base in the live cattle price, you know, pretty close to these current levels. I'd be, you know, unless we get a really disastrous lack of an autumn break in the southern states in Australia, and we turn to a real significant drought scenarios, we head into kind of spring and summer and later into the year, I think we're probably looking at a stage where prices are going to stabilise across the country here in Australia, and certainly that's going to lend some support to live export as well at these levels, I think.
Live exports of sheep to the Middle East have been in the news over the last couple of weeks. That's been heavily scrutinised about some of the deaths that have occurred on ships. Has that had any flow-on impacts for the cattle live trade?
Look, I don't. In terms of price and volumes, I don't think it's had a real impact. I guess the main aspect of that, I think the live cattle trade are looking closely at what eventuates with regard to live sheep, just from a concern of potentially, a contagion of the issues that are currently confronting the live sheep trade. Live cattle is a different scenario from the perspective of. You know, certainly the historic mortality rates are far lower for live cattle than what they are sheep, so it is a different game. But I think there's an aspect of concern that in the event that something significant happens with regards to live sheep, say in terms of a ban, whether it's permanent or temporary, you know, is that going to over time kind of creep into the live cattle side? And there's a little bit of a concern there, so you know, it's not affecting the market, so to speak, but I think participants are just watching it with bated breath.
And we did see, as I mentioned earlier, some impact in the markets at Mouche last week in the cattle market. It wasn't just what's the conversation and discussion, debate going on with the live export industry at the moment, but it was a number of other factors too, in terms of the numbers, the seasonal conditions too, playing a role. But definitely that debate around live exports coming into that equation last week. We'll see if it's the same again this week, and we'll get the details with John Testrow just before the news at 1 when we take you to Mouche cattle market. ABC, 20 past 12.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Well, sometimes the people right at the top of their game, doesn't matter what industry you're talking about, need to get back to basics, to get a more sound knowledge of the product that they're actually selling. And this is happening in the grains industry. Some of the top people, the top minds in the industry, are getting to know more about wheat quality. And you know what? I reckon they're enjoying it because they've got the chance to head off and visit flour mills, test the flour, and this is the great part, even get to bake the bread. The Australian Export Grains Innovation Centre is running these courses, and the centre's Dr. Ken Quayle says when you've been in the industry a long time, you can often think, you know, I know everything about this, but that's not always the case.
We hope that by providing training in understanding the value of Australian wheat, that grain traders and other parts of the supply chain can more effectively see the value of Australian grain in the market, and through recognising the value and being able to sell more effectively against that value, get fairer prices for the grain in market.
These are some pretty experienced or people who have significant experience within the wheat industry already. I mean, what do they get out of doing this kind of course?
Yeah, on our most recent course, we did have some quite experienced people from the flour milling industry and also from the grain trade and also one of our large biscuit manufacturers. But those people rarely get the opportunity to see how it all fits together. They work in their own space, whether it's in a flour mill or trading grain, but they rarely see how the grain goes right from the measurement of grain quality all the way through to milling and then making products such as bread and noodles out of the flour produced from that wheat. And so by packaging all that up together, you're actually able to translate what it means to buy certain grades of wheat and why they're valued by our customers, and also relate that to how the value might compare to our competitors. And so they really then have a sense of how they can package that information to work more effectively with their customers.
So throughout the course, I mean, what are the kind of things that they're actually doing physically, seeing and learning?
The course pretty much goes from measuring grain quality to spending time actually in the mill and understanding how the milling process works. And most people think that flour milling is probably really simple. It's just grinding up wheat. But it's actually, to do it commercially and economically, it's actually quite a complicated process. So it's getting a sense of how that works. Then how we test the flour quality, creating the sort of data that a customer of flour would normally look at to understand the functionality of that flour. And then we actually make end products. So they go into the bakery and produce bread, and they also work in our noodle lab and produce noodles. And that way they see how the measurements you make on the wheat and the flour translate into actual outcomes for those final products. And so you get a sense of when you change a parameter in the wheat, how it actually makes a difference to the product that the consumer actually sees on the retail shelf.
Ken, how important is it for the entire production chain to be on message, essentially?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Tara. So by being on message, I think we're going to be much more effective at extracting value from the market. And that really means finding the fair price for our grain. And so by everyone understanding the terminology and also understanding where our benefits lie, we can protect them more from all the way from production through to supply. So even at the grower level, this information is really useful because if you understand better how the quality of the grain that you produce has an impact in market, it's much more likely that you'll seek to protect that value. And that's the same for the trade or the flour millers in realising that value all the way through. So having a consistent message really helps that understanding.
When can we expect to see some results, or are we already starting to see some?
Oh, well, it's a hard thing to measure, but I think that the people attending are consistently saying that this is going to make a difference to how they do business. So I think, you know, that suggests that we are seeing the benefits of this, but it's a gradual process and those differences are incremental, so they're not going to kind of radically change the world, but I think that they continue to make small differences that build, and it provides us with a much stronger position going forward.
That's the Australian Export Grains Innovation Centre's Dr. Ken Quayle catching up there with Tara de Langraft. 25 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Checking in with news headlines and a look at the weather. Not great conditions around the Southwest Land Division over the weekend for those wanting rain. And I know you're probably in that situation where a lot of dry seeding has gone on and now the wait is on to get that rain. We'll check conditions for the rest of the week. And going back to the conversation I had with the Bureau on Friday, it didn't look promising. Maybe things have changed. We'll check in with the Weather Bureau shortly just to see what is on the horizon. But let's look around to other parts of Australia now, because similar sorts of conditions, really. If we take a look now at farmers in the southeast of New South Wales, they're really battling through what many of them are saying is one of the worst droughts on record. Josh Becker caught up with farmers at a drought feeding workshop, which was at a town called Delegat, which is just on the New South Wales-Victorian border. And one of the people he caught up with was wool producer John Turner, and he says it's up there with the worst droughts he's seen.
I've owned land just here since 1974. I believe the water situation is as bad as I've seen since then. And I think the feed situation is probably on that 20-year scenario, as bad as I've seen in the last 20.
So describe the water situation at the moment for you.
Dam's very, very low. The springs are OK. It's not going to be a major disaster, but it's you know, there's a few gates open. So several paddocks having to run into the one dam, yeah.
Mm. And what about the livestock? What sort of condition are they in at the moment?
They're very good. Sheep numbers are down 20%. Young ewes are four score, very good order. Merino weaners are on self-feeders, have been for about 6 weeks. Cattle are a worry. They're probably going on the market in the next week or so.
So you've already made decisions about feeding and destocking already?
I smelled her out at the beginning of last year because we'd had seven consecutive good years in this district you could see it coming, so yeah, I've been preparing for quite a while. Yeah.
And what are you hearing from other farmers? They're all out at your place today to talk about just some strategies that can be put in place. What are you hearing from neighbours?
Yeah, well, it looks like there's about 50 people here, which is wonderful. I think people know it's pretty serious down here. It could test us out, yeah.
Doug Alcock from Gras Profit Consulting in Cooma.
Doug, how would you describe conditions around Delegat and the southern Monaro at the moment?
Oh, look, I'd say it's probably as bad as it gets at this time of year. You know, there's really no standing feed left. They're really down to the point where ground cover is starting to become an issue and no green feed. It's all hands on deck for drought feeding.
You've been speaking with producers about feed strategy, so what's the key message that you're trying to get across to them today?
I guess to be proactive and just get in early before things get even tighter. Stock are in generally good condition at the moment, so there's a little bit of fat in the system, but that's going to disappear over the next month to 6 weeks, so they have to plan ahead to have the feed on hand and to start their feeding programs in a timely manner before things get critical.
And this is drought feeding that people are moving into, not regular winter feeding.
No, that's right. I mean, we don't, you know, typically on the Monaro we'd have inadequate quantities of green pick over winter. There's no green pick. And, the prospect of getting anything useful between now and winter is pretty low, I think, given the Bureau's outlook and the fact that nothing much grows once May's finished.
You keep a close eye on the outlooks. What's your sense of where things are going for farmers and what they should be thinking about for the next few months?
Yeah, look, I think really they're looking down the barrel of having a feeding program for breeding ewes and young sheep and cattle, really all animals on the farm, over the next 3 months. From that, it's really just going to depend on what sort of winter rain we get and how quickly we can come out of winter with spring. I'd be planning ahead for perhaps some continued feeding into that early spring period as well.
The alternative to feeding is destocking. Are you seeing much of that amongst the people that you've been speaking to?
Not yet. I think most people have sort of held out a bit. And the other thing is that commodity prices are really good and grain prices are not ridiculously high yet. So, if people were to stock up and get their requirements for the winter, the economics really stack up for retaining stock. And continuing at those higher stocking rates coming out of winter at the moment.
David Mitchell runs a wool and sheepmeat enterprise at Corowong Delegate. He says this drought is different and commodity prices are a big factor.
We're looking at a very extensive winter of feeding everything, and certainly in the last month we've actually started to put sheep into drought lots, and We've got about 4,000 ewes in drought lot now, and we'll be probably moving another couple in the next month.
Have you looked at destocking, or you're hoping to carry as much as you can through?
Look, I think with the current commodity prices, particularly in sheep, both wool and meat, mutton and lamb, it would pay to feed through the winter, and certainly we want to come out at springtime fully functional in our sheep enterprise. So we're sort of banking on a spring. There's a little bit of risk in that, but I think we're also gearing ourselves up for the future years ahead, that we want good numbers around us in those enterprises.
And people are talking about, they're saying it is a drought in these conditions at the moment. How does it compare to previous years?
Yeah, certainly I think for Andrea and myself, the worst drought situation we've been through here at Delegate was in the late 90s. And certainly that really affected the Delegate community. Talking to some of the local farmers here, I think some areas around Bombala and Delegate are not as bad as that period, but certainly the area around Bendock, just across the border, is worse than that situation. I think the real difference between the late 90s drought and this one, which is definitely a drought, would be commodity prices.
Mm-hmm. And also the run-in over the last couple of years, it has been quite good to producers on the Monero.
Oh, we've had 5 cracking years, so everyone has to have their turn in this game, Josh, and I think for the older generations that we're quite good at feeding during dry periods. It's just conveying to the youth now coming on that this is part of the game.
There is a bit of it around the country right now, isn't there? There's that wait for rain. And that's David Mitchell. He runs a wool and sheep business at Corowong. And he was one of the many people, around about 50 or so, catching up at the drought feeding workshop. This is at Delegate on the New South Wales Victorian border. But many in your community too, hand feeding at the moment with the dry conditions. We'll check in with the Weather Bureau in just a moment or two. First, the news headlines. Ali Colvin in the studio. Hi, Ali.
Thanks, Belinda. The opposition leader is ramping up his attacks on the coalition's company tax cuts ahead of next week's federal budget, describing tax relief for the big banks as immoral in light of shocking evidence from the Banking Royal Commission. The government's plan to cut the company tax rate for all businesses has stalled in the Senate as the coalition negotiates with key crossbenchers. The state government says funding will be the major stumbling block for proposed changes to the education system. David Gonski has released his latest report into the state of the nation's education system and has called for closer attention to the needs of individual students. The state education minister, Sue Ellery, says while much of the report makes sense, the state can't afford to put more money into the sector. Researchers at the University of WA are set to test the effect of medicinal cannabis on adults with chronic insomnia. Researchers say about one in three Australians has regular difficulty sleeping, and the trial will look at whether the sedation effect of cannabis can help. Thanks, Belinda. Back with more at 1.
Thank you for the update, Ali Colvin. 25 to 1.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
How's your afternoon? Hope you're ticking things off on your list this afternoon. Shortly, talking about mutton, and apparently all you need to do is age the mutton a little bit, and it turns into this mouth-watering, buttery, chocolatey type meat. And apparently if you go into the restaurant and you're looking at the menu and you see a choice of mutton and lamb, when the mutton is cooked this particular way or gone through this aging process, you will go for the mutton every time. And I know many of you already do because Les at Gero, hi Les, says leg mutton and veggies roasted with lashings of gravy. That's the secret, I think, the lashings of gravy. Bloody heaven. Thank you for that, Les. The text, if you'd like to be part of the program, have your 2 cents worth, 0448 922 604. We're off to the market, the Miche Cattle Market, and John Testro will have the details for you shortly. Right now, Robbie Rivette from the Weather Bureau going to talk you through conditions around Western Australia. How's it looking in northern and eastern parts, Robbie?
Good afternoon. I guess we're starting to ease off as we're heading through May now. So we're starting to see storms really just over the Kimberley, over the northwestern parts. We saw a couple last night over the Mitchell Plateau, very similar for this afternoon. They seem to push all the way towards the west and sitting offshore of the Pilbara. You might see the odd strike form inland of Karratha for us today and again tomorrow. But nothing too extreme. They're very isolated, and you're probably quite unlucky if you're under one over there. As we go through the week, the fronts that go through the south have a trough sitting through central parts. So you're starting to see some storms form through the interior and down through far eastern parts of the goldfields from Wednesday. They probably get a little bit stronger as they push into the it's more into the SA side, so more down towards the Eucla even. You might see a bit more rainfall out of them. It does push up to around Warburton into Thursday and then contracts into the SA side of the border.
How many mils are we looking at there, Robbie?
Not really too much. It's probably active, so probably scattered storms, but you're not really looking at high rainfall totals. I guess they're around that 5-10 mils sort of thing, so nothing too extreme.
All right, let's move into the Southwest Land Division, and a little bit of rain would be nice in some parts as seeding is well and truly underway around Western Australia. Anything on the horizon?
We have a few weak fronts going through. The strongest one will go through Wednesday, and probably this one on Wednesday is probably more going to be windy. It's about three of these fronts going through. They're not very strong. In terms of rainfall, you're probably looking at drizzle sort of rainfall, and most of it's probably going to fall around the southwest parts of the state, so down from about Juryan Bay to Narrogin down to Israelite Bay, so really just coastal. On that Wednesday, so early Tuesday is when it passes through the Albany and south coast parts into Esperance in the afternoon. In those, you might see a bit more intense showers, but they're not going to be long-lived, just some good solid showers, but nothing too much in terms of rainfall for us coming over these series of fronts.
And Robbie, any warnings today?
We have no warnings today. We will have a strong wind warning tomorrow as the first front starts to move through, setting along from Cape Lewin to Bremer Bay.
Good. Thank you for the details this afternoon. ABC WA, this is the Country Hour, and it's 21 to 1. Just a quick glance at the rainfall figures in the last, well, this is Monday, so it's 72 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. So looking at the figures over the weekend, and not a lot there. Nothing of significance in northern and eastern parts. And looking at the Southwest Land Division, just one of note, there must have been a big cloud over many peaks. So in the southern coastal region, many peaks, 9 in the gauge over the weekend. 20 to 1. Speaking of the rain, and I know you probably looking for some in your patch. If you have had some at your place, very often it's been quite patchy. But still, in some of the grain growing areas, that hasn't really stopped anything going on, and the seeding still is underway or already done at your place. Narrogin-based agronomist Helen Wyatt says in Western Australia's Great Southern region, a lot of the seeding has been done, a lot of it going in dry. So, as usual, you've probably got everything crossed, just hoping for rain at this stage.
Yeah, it definitely has. Sort of had mixed rainfall reports the last week, anywhere from sort of 25 to 3 mils. So some people are going full steam ahead and some are probably not so much of a rush, but there's definitely quite a bit of clover pasture seed in the ground and also some canola that's gone in. Yeah, so ticking away.
So forecast isn't looking too good. Are people a bit disappointed?
Yeah, I think so. It's still relatively early, so I don't think anyone's hit panic stations yet. Obviously, yeah, those that sort of didn't get the rain will probably start dry sowing canola if they haven't already. But just bearing in mind as the date gets later and later, they might make changes to their program or switch crop types or change paddocks a little bit.
Are people starting to have a look at their agronomy plans a bit closer now?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, with different moisture levels, some of the herbicides and insecticides work in different ways. So a bit more strategy around when we might apply different chemistry is definitely in people's minds, just to maximise the efficiency and to also leave their options open if they are going to change crop type or if they are going to possibly put it back to pasture or something, just keeping their options open.
And when are people looking to get cereals in the ground?
Yeah, I'd say a few gone in. Some of the longer season varieties, there's definitely a bit of barley and oats in. And I reckon as of next week, I mean, the 10th of May, I suppose, is a typical date that most people will definitely go with cereals. So this coming week, next week, yeah, there'll be some dry sowing. A few will probably wait and see what the forecast does, but yeah, we won't know.
Narrogin Elders agronomist Helen Wyatt catching up with the ABC's Kit Mockin. ABC WA on the Country Hour, it's 18 to 1. Western Australia's community resource centres have just received an email, right now in fact, with the news that their budgets have been slashed by 40%. So from $13 million to around $8 million. Now there are more than 100 CRCs here in WA and they perform all sorts of different community functions and give people access to government and also community services. Now, the proposal to cut CRC funding is not new. You first heard that the government was considering it round about 12 months ago. And since then, CRCs have been lobbying against the cuts, saying it's going to reduce essential services in regional Western Australia. Sharon Bell is the manager of the Delwollinew CRC. Now, Sharon, you've just received this email. Can you tell us what it says?
Hi, yes. We've just received an email in the past 30 minutes regarding the proposed cuts to the funding. The department is actually giving us until the 20th of May to submit feedback on these proposed cuts.
Okay, so this isn't the final word on this, but it's just detailing what is potentially ahead for you. How are the cuts? Is it just across the board that these CRCs get a cut? Is that the proposal or it's more detailed than that?
It's a little bit more detailed than that. They've identified 76 CRCs that will be classified as Tier 1 CRCs where they will receive funding of $70,000 ex-GST per year. There's then another 26 or 27, I think, that are Tier 2 CRCs who will then be receiving $50,000 a year.
All right, so they're cuts for both the Tier 1 and the Tier 2 CRCs?
They are significant cuts for both of the levels. I was actually quite surprised to see them identify in the two different tiers.
All right. And what does that mean for you? My understanding is that yours, the Delwollinew CRC, fits into the Tier 1 category. What does that cut, what does that funding you possibly now have to work with mean to you?
It will mean a reduction in services that we are required to deliver under our current contract. The government has identified that there are duplication of services that could possibly be funded through either federal or other state government departments or other external organisations. And they're basically saying that you don't have to be delivering certain services now, that and because of that, they will be able, you know, they're going to cut the funding.
So will you be able to go on and function, or will there be, I mean, maybe not yours, but other community resource centres around the state, will they may have to shut down as a result of the funding cuts?
I think there's going to be significant financial pressure on some of the CRCs, given that I, just going through the email that's been sent out, one of the huge changes to the proposed fundings that comes under their considerations is that they're looking at cutting the traineeship program, or reviewing it. They've stated that the traineeship program would not have enough budget to allow for every CRC to have a trainee at any given time, and that the program will need to be reviewed to develop new grant guidelines. So given that currently the traineeship program funds us or funds every trainee to about $20,000, that's going to be a severe blow to a lot of CRCs who really utilise their trainees as additional staff members.
On ABC WA, this is The Country Hour. I'm Belinda Varaschetti, and you're listening to Sharon Bell. She's the manager of the Del Wolyneu Community Resource Centre. And just in the last half an hour, Sharon and the other CRCs receiving an email from the state government saying that their budgets are going to be significantly slashed by around about 40%, and Sharon just going through the details of that. Obviously wanting to get feedback from the CRC, so this is not final. This is the proposal that's been put forward in this email. You can be part of the conversation too if you're involved in a CRC. Let me know what the implications are for you. The text 0448 922 604. Sharon, you mentioned the traineeships. You're really concerned about the future of that. What's going to be the biggest loss to regional communities as a result of these cuts, besides that traineeship program you're talking about?
DPIRD is talking about a reduction in the delivery of training and development activities in the areas of economic and social development. So under our current contract, we're supposed to do grassroots development in the areas of economic, business and social. With the reduction in the delivery of those workshops, that could see a significant impact on our local communities in the availability to access, you know, appropriate trainings that they require. They have indicated that some of the training may be able to be continued in a user pays system, which is appropriate for those CRCs that deliver or facilitate a lot of accredited trainings. But it does mean that any of the information sessions that we provide that are business orientated will either have to be cut, or any attendees will have to pay a fee to attend those type of trainings. And one of the big impacts that have changed a lot of the or that have determined as to whether or not some of the CRCs are going to be Tier 2 is the closeness to each other. So there are some communities that are less than 50 kilometres apart that have CRCs located there. So if they're too close to each other, they're actually going to be classified as Tier 2 and have their funding cut.
Elena McTiernan, as you mentioned earlier, Sharon, she's asked the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development to undertake this review of the CRC programs and to provide her with options. And in the email that you have just received, the Minister also seeking feedback from the CRCs themselves. What is going to be your feedback?
I haven't had a good chance to actually study the full document yet, and I will be obviously consulting with my management committee on to what our recommendations will be regard to that.
And you said that you thought this was coming. I mean, you did have the heads up about 12 months or so ago, but you've been surprised by what you've read so far, the extent of the cuts.
I was quite surprised more by them identifying the tiers. So, for example, in the Tier 2 funding, they're working on the size of the population of the community. So for any communities over 3,000 people, they're saying that the their CRC will be a Tier 2, which means that they will get less funding. If there's a location in relation to other CRC service providers, less than 30 kilometres between towns, so that impacts on some of the CRCs that are located in the wheat belt.
Good to talk to you, and thank you for going through that. I really appreciate it, Sharon, and you've only just received that email, so good to go through the details at first blush anyway here on the Country Hour this afternoon. Sharon Bell, she's the manager of the Del Wolyneu Community Resource Centres, and just receiving that news that the state government intends to cut the budgets for the CRCs and placing them into two different tiers or categories. Nothing final at this stage. The CRCs will be able to give some feedback to the government. ABC WA, this is the Country Hour, 8 minutes to one. Well, sheep farmers could get double the price for mutton if it's dry aged rather than wet aged. Now, that's the view of some meat experts who've been studying this and the potential demand for dry-aged sheep meat here in Australia. Now, you know about dry aging. You would have seen it in the butcher before because it's been done with beef for a long time. But researchers and chefs think the technique can be used to make mutton taste just as good, if not better, than lamb. But as Marty McCarthy reports, the challenge will be convincing you and meat processors to give it a go.
So it's bubbling nicely. It's not going too golden brown, too dark, too quick.
This mutton is about to get a makeover.
We're making the mutton piccata. So we've used the silver side and we've sliced it thinly, about 2 or 3 mil, lightly crumbed it, a little bit of parmesan, some parsley and some lemon. And then we're just shallow frying it.
Dale Lyman is a chef at Melbourne Cooking School, the William Angliss Institute. And he's trying to dress up dry-aged mutton.
Okay, so we need to make sure this is nice and hot.
It's a process used already for beef, but a handful of producers in Australia are using the technique to improve the taste of mutton, which has long fallen out of favour with Australian palates.
When we first saw the mutton, we didn't quite know what to do with, but after a lot of trial, we've come up with some really good dishes and we've really learnt a lot about the animal and how the best way to cook it.
He's also serving it in sliders and Vietnamese soup.
It's just a fantastic opportunity to keep trying all these different things.
A group of food experts from the University of Melbourne are looking at whether there's demand for it in Australia. The university's enterprise director, Hollis Ashman, is one of them.
It's that complex, rich, buttery flavour, and those butter notes are ones that are incredibly craveable. And so it almost becomes almost like chocolate. And so think of it almost as the chocolate of meats.
Dry aging involves the drying and dehydration of meat in a controlled environment for a number of weeks or months to draw out more flavours.
Crust grows on the outside of the meat, and the inside of the meat becomes very tender, very juicy, and the flavours and all the enzymes concentrate, and it tastes really good.
The process is already used for beef and is more common in Europe and the United States. Now sheep farmers in the west of the country are pioneering the industry for sheep meat. Robin Jacobs from Western Australia's Department of Primary Industry says making it commercial will be good for foodies and farmers.
Well, traditionally, wet aged mutton goes for quite a low price, so it's a low value product that's often about half the price of lamb. So the idea of this product is that we try to get the value up to a similar value to what lamb is. So, you know, potentially we could double the value of meat that comes from older animals.
Dry aging sheep meat takes about a month. That's longer than the usual ageing period that most meatworks have capacity for, which is around a week.
Yeah, it's outside the normal sort of ageing period that people use for meat, and processors at this point in time haven't really shown a lot of interest in it. But as I say, we've got some people that, you know, some specialty type people that are actually doing it already, and we think there's potential there for the wider processing community to sort of pick it up.
Professor Robin Warner is an expert in meat science at Melbourne University. She's just started a research project to determine how old a sheep can get while still being tasty under dry ageing processes.
We're going to be trialling 4 to 8 year old ewes in this. We're collecting samples at the moment from carcasses, and we're putting them through wet ageing and dry ageing, and they range from 4 to 8 years old. So we are trying 8 years. We actually really wanted to limit it to 6 years, but it's quite hard to get enough animals. So we had to go from 4 to 8 years old in the ewes that we worked with. So we can answer that in a couple of months when we have some more results as to what the quality's like.
She says being able to kill sheep for meat at the end of their life cycle could mean big bucks for producers.
And I was talking to a producer the other day, and they've got a very large flock. It's a big company, 100,000 ewes, and they're culling 5% of their ewes every year, which is a very routine practice to cull your ewes, so you're actually able to take those animals. You need to make sure there's very good fat cover on the animal, so they do need to have good feeding pre-slaughter.
Hollis Ashman says it would help to make sheep farming one of the most sustainable livestock sectors.
And what I mean by that is we're talking about sheep that are older, and so they've generated a number of fleeces, they've generated a number of lambs, and then finally they're having one last bad day, and we're now having to begin to taste them. That's very different than any other meat, because there is no other meat that can generate that many versions of value for what we do. And so it really becomes the sustainable meat that if you want to save the planet, this is the one to eat.
But the challenge will be getting consumers to bite in.
The fundamental issue for Australia is a typically conservative marketplace when they look at new products. And so the easier way to think about bringing new things for Australians to consider and try is to go into a restaurant. Because when you go to a restaurant, a chef says, hey, this is going to be good. You believe the chef, you try it, and then you decide typically what we see within 2 to 3 years. Then it becomes a retail product where consumers want it in their home.
Hollis Ashman from Melbourne University, making you hungry, talking about that buttery, chocolatey mutton on your plate this afternoon. ABC WA 2.5 to 1. Off to the market now to Mouche and the results of the cattle market today. 1,166 head of cattle sold at Mouche this morning. That's down 500 on last week. John Testrow, did the live exporters play much of a part in today's market?
Yeah, good afternoon, Belinda. Well, they were back in the market again today, Belinda, but very selective in their purchasing. But it had an effect on the market overall. We saw values up generally around about 10 cents being a lift right throughout. But that's still 20 cents down on the market a fortnight ago following last week's knee-jerk reaction to the uncertainty, the immediate future of the live trade. But one thing I would like to say about today's yarding was very, very poor quality and a real reflection on the season out in the pastoral areas. Fearless steers were local. They sold from 156 to 288, to average 270. They remained firm. Local Vela heifers sold mainly from 100 to 272, to average 208. They were down 3 cents. Yearling steers local were grain assisted from 242 to 284, to average 262. They were up by 5 cents. Pastorals from 120 to 292, up by 10 cents. Yearling heifers pastoral under 330 kilos, at 50 to 196, up 10 cents. The over 330 kilos at 150 to 240 to feeders remain firm. Local content were over 330 kilos in the yearling heifer department and mainly grain supplementary fed. They sold from 178 to 290 cents, but were down 10 cents, and that was on a poor selection. from 218 to 250, up by 4 cents. Grown heifers, very few yarded, sold at 250 cents to remain firm. Cows, very lightweight, the feeders, they were of very poor quality. They sold from mainly 50 cents to 166, they were down 15 cents. Score 2 medium weights from 178 to 182, up by 5 cents. And prime from 188 to 208 were up 10 cents. In the bulls, this is where the live export came in. The lightweight defeaters sold from 150 to 240, up by 10 cents. Live exporters paid 200 to 312. They were up by 30 cents. Medium weights to the same at 150 to 234.
And it's 1 o'clock.